But as many of you know, Kevin is not only an amazing author, actor, but he's an amazing musician, I'm much better than Keith Richards. But anyway, so get started this evening. We've been taking over the MoMA for this special book that everybody has here this evening. It just ties in so beautifully to it. Just to kickstart it, for all of you, why did you write Exploring You?
Why did we choose the Explorer's Guild as a sort of starting point for this story? I don't mean to be phrasing all your questions, we'll be there on that. I think it came from a friend of mine about 8 or 9 years ago. A friend of mine's wife was in New York working in journalism. She profiled the Explorers Club in Manhattan. And I think she sort of brought that idea home as kind of a neat idea, a fictionalized version of these explorers, these sort of a fun hub for all innumerable stories of exploration. I think it started from there. And we took this kind of wild, half-formed idea around about a semi-secret society of people who ventured out from the known world into the unknown, in fact, filled the flying spaces on the map. And we were also presenting it as a return of classic adventure storytelling. And we had a chance to bring it in front of Kevin. And I think as a fan of the same old books that we love so much, he sparked to it pretty quickly. And that's where the collaboration started.
And Rick and Kevin, what was the attraction for you? Was it basically the inner child, something presently missing? What was the attraction?
Well, the first time I talked to John, sounds like now I didn't understand. Sure. And he had this half-baked idea. No, there was just something in him. Sometimes you get a feeling from people. But in truth, I did have a little difficulty with loading cities. I wasn't sure secret societies. I'm like, okay, I'm all about secrets. I get it. And I'm all about finding stuff. But I didn't really have a grasp of it. And this was 8 years ago. You know, sometimes people think these things just happen overnight. This has been an 8-year journey for us. And I asked him to come up to the house up to Santa Barbara where I live. I said, I want you to take another stab at this floating city. And he did. And I have to be perfectly honest, he wasn't that effective the second time. But I liked him even more. There was something about John. And we started off on a adventure. We actually created 22 minutes of animation of the Explorer's Guild. We tried to tell our story that way, and we thought at one point that the film community would see this and see what a big kind of epic journey this could be. And they just looked at it and went, where's it going? Who's it for? All these questions, these demographic questions that were almost like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. And I thought, we're going to make a great story here. But really, it wasn't enough for them. And there's a level of disappointment that comes with working in Hollywood. There's also a level of, it also in success, your career can be absolutely elevated there. And John experienced with a lot of artists, really, that, well, we had this good idea, and it didn't, you know, manifest itself in any kind of way that you could take home to your mom or what would happen.
A cute comeback, you know, because this is where we turn things around.
And out of that, John said, you know, John's experience has always been in writing books. And he goes, I think we should just write the book. And I said, good, now I think you should write the book. We worked it up on the story, but that's not really what I do. And 3.5 years ago, John started to write this book. And at a certain point, Rick, who's a one-of-a-kind person, entered into it. But that's what happened about 3.5 years ago. We started this book. We could be here tonight and to watch John be able to, I don't know, I just see both of them.
visuals.
Incredible story.
Many of you probably don't know, but Rick is one of the leading illustrators, not only in the United States, but the world. So why don't you tell us about these lush visuals? Because they really add this interesting dimension to the story and really enhance it.
Well, a big part of it was when I came on a project about 3.5 years ago. 8 years. Total time the project took. So I'm a relative late on it. Kind of nice to tell the story about the family.
It's not that you have money, but it's part of the life. It's not looking at the
papers. So, he asked me to do what
you really cast on that.
Okay, now let me describe how you have to be one, right? But it's basically what it got to you.
And well, I thought we were something. I said, who's going to do all this? And John said, well, I'll find somebody. And then he told me he found somebody. I was really happy. And of course, it's the word together.
I think we got that
part or something.
What happened?
Did everyone praise this?
Well, so he asked earlier, what was my attraction to the story? Well, the job. So I saw this, and I was like, Winsor McKay is one of my heroes. He was one of the giants of early 20th century Sunday comics. So I, immediately my attraction was, who in the world is asking about this artist who no one has heard of? Can you draw this guy? So I immediately answered the ad. And John looked at my portfolio and liked it and said, hey, maybe you can do a test page for us.
We'll pay for it.
Yeah.
And
we'll pay.
And now we'll say, well, one of us will do it for it.
We'll pay for it.
That's serious. It's unfortunate we come out from behind the curtain, so we're being funny today. In fact, we didn't want, there are people who are who sort of want us just for a name. I mean, we didn't want that, but we're doing just as money at that
point. When you get something like this, how do you feel about illustrating? What's the process?
It's very much about the weaving together of words and pictures. I mean, it's all storytelling. So it starts with John's text. He would send me his words, and I would start to read those and get a feel and a sense for what he was trying to do in the story. And then we would go back and forth. John is actually a great illustrator as well, and a great designer and great director. So we were going ideas back and forth, trying to figure out what was going to be the best way to tell this story. And match the kind of, the sort of older craftsmanship of his writing, the formalism of his writing. And, at first I came to it with much more sort of contemporary, cinematic-based kind of graphic novel.
Let me sort of start developing a picture of Kevin as a guy who sort of finds two knuckleheads kind of playing around in a standby. He, from the beginning, was right down there with us. So, we may talk about my words or Rick's that. I hate for you to leave here with an impression of Kevin as the celebrity who showed up as the books were coming out press, but I'm sure his name is on there. Otherwise, the first time he reads it is when it comes out off the press. From the beginning, Rick says that the development of the project preceded him by, 4 years or so. That was all just working on the story and letting Kevin, in that time, Kevin and I also spent 2.5 years on co-writing a Western, so very much in the rhythm of taking his ideas, and he sometimes taking them for the line. That one says maybe not too many. Yeah. This way. And we were sort of kind of very natural in how we can drill into a little bit about how that was, but by the time stuff reached Rick, it was really a product of what work we had been doing. Rick came from a very varied background. I think what I saw most in his portfolio was the number of different sort of styles he could work in. But when you approach this as a graphic novel, there's a lot of, what I found was that there was a lot of unlearning that had to be done to fit what we were going for. In the way I was telling him, I remember I'm being on the phone with him, there was a Saturday Night Live once about a Japanese broadcaster that takes over an American network, and every single thing that happens is high drama. You think it's going to be sort of regular sitcom. A man comes home from work, there's a bear that knocks at the door, he opens the door and it's a bear. What's he going to do? There's no time to explain, he's got to fight the bear, and it's like everything with, sort of the jangles in that. It's a very popular way to dramatize action, and, if you look at some of these things, they will be showing there's a picture on the mantle, or there's a coffee mug in it. Like, everything's turned to 11, and my feeling was that we had every single thing looked like you're being sort of thrown down the hallway at something. Where could we go from there? Like, where, by the time you actually have it, you're like, this is going to have to start coming quietly and build and kind of gather. So that was a little bit of that back and forth in the beginning.
Yeah, and so based on that, and again, on the writing that I was reading, it's just, amazing. It's really beyond anything that I've ever had a chance to work on. You started looking at some of the more, it said in the early 20th century, so we started looking at that period in illustration, looking at Charles David Gibson, who was a white magazine illustrator, looking at N.C. Wyatt, who was one of the preeminent adventure story illustrators of that day, and trying to incorporate that feel for the action adventure books that we really love from that era when we were here. And so, to give that kind of more formal feel to the work, and also the real sort of handmade craftsmanship to the drawing itself.
And how did you decide to put it against the backdrop of World War I?
I think you just got the book, and I don't know if there's time for us to take pause and maybe even read it. Always. I'll give you just the sort of crazy of the thing. It basically, it is World War I, and there's a society of explorers kind of canvassing the globe, looking for this mythical city called Shambhala. And what you find is that the war and really the fate of civilization are all tied into the city and its secrets. So it's critical that the place be found, and important that it be found by the right people, and just important that we keep the wrong people out of it. So it's all about, what is this city? Can it be found? Who can get there first? And how do we really know who's supposed to find it and who's supposed to be kept away? That's not really kind of the end. Your question, why World War I? I think part of it was having the world be in a state where a lot of people thought this really might be the end. I mean, this is more on a scale that had not been seen before. And it ties in with it. There is a sort of Buddhist prophecy about a time of rising technology and gathering chaos in the world when somebody, not because they are one of the spiritually elect, but because they're clever enough to find a way into this city, breaches its wall. And that is sort of the sign that this, in the old text, real like text, the golden army is going to come through. It's their version of the apocalypse. So that's like all of this is actually happening. And in our fictionalized version of it, that prophecy is kind of, we kind of take it as gospel and kind of go from there.
How did you decide to break new ground by releasing it? Two books, this will be released in the future, animated series, and also live action film, which is
well, I am to a certain extent when we decided that we would just take this straight to a novel. One of the things that I wanted to do was, we live in artistically now, in movies specifically, maybe even music, and I'm sure books, because this is my first entry in movie. We have an editorial process already sitting on our our shoulder. Got to speed this up. Got to get this thing going. I'm not sure people will stand still for this. We got to know exactly where this is going within the first 100 pages, within the first 20 pages. And when we decided to make this a book, you know, a little bit of the temptation could have been to put up a big signpost where the movie exists. If you read this novel, you'd be really clear where this movie's going. And when we made the jump to the book, the one thing I said is, let's not worry about the movie anymore. There may never, ever be a movie. Let's make a great novel. You go to business. And that was something that I really wanted to give John a bigger yard to operate in, to not edit himself, because I thought that he wouldn't be at his best if he had somebody constantly whispering, whispering in his ear about, pick it up. And I think at that point, that's when I started to enter into the process. As pages started to go back and forth, and we began to shift with it. I'd like it to be a movie someday, but I don't ever care if it will be. This is probably one of the greatest experiences I ever had in my life. There's room to exploit it in the best possible way. But it really became what I wanted it to be. Not that it is. It became what I wanted it to be, in the sense that, we reached back into another century for these great storytellers. They're all on our shelf. Last century, the century before that. Who's writing for us? Who's creating these kind of stories now? And that's what I hoped, is that we could create a book that had heft, had girth, that made a sound. You said it on the dinner table. It made that sound. And that it could somehow take its place up there next to Jules Verne, to Conrad, to Mark Twain. And I really wanted that more than anything, that you could get on your tiptoes and reach up and pull it off and blow the dust off and pack it the way you do and say, let's read some of these floors here tonight. And I think that was achieved. And we don't know how the book will be received, but we did edit ourselves. We didn't try to make a movie, try to make a book. And that's what you have in your hands. And hopefully this is a book that will be being read in colleges, will be being read 100 years from now. The temptation for everything is to measure something by how well it does in the quote-unquote marketplace. And I think we all know there's so much evidence to prove that that's not the value of anything. It's something that will be shared years from now and passed down and an heirloom, if you will. And, that's what we wanted. Feels a little poetic, but that's the way I like to swing for the fences.
Well, you have something very, very special this evening.
Tell me, with some of these books and authors that you describe it, I grew up reading them, and many of us grew up reading them. Where did it's so warmly welcome that you have done this book, which many of us think is to be really widely received. Where did this golden age of adventure storytelling, where did it go? It's so popular.
A lot of times, if you think about it, those authors were the same people that actually were in the jungles and were on fishing boats and on freighters that would go back and forth. I was reading Jenny Gray's autobiography, and he was in fist fights. He was on trains with hobos. He was on ships that made their way to the South Pacific. These guys were writing about stuff often that, in ways that you could tell that they actually participated, running. So it's that's where they went. So maybe people are playing video games and then trying to write high adventure. Ooh, so scary. so scary. And, I think one of the things that appealed to me is writing about when our hero gets into trouble or the third person we're following, that they don't have some magic weapon that's going to get them out of trouble. They may have their fists, or they have to think with their head, their wits, their resourcefulness to get them out of trouble. And these are hard-boiled, hard-hearted men that we follow.
And if you wouldn't, sorry about that. Yeah, clarify that. We had a pointed question about that earlier today. Yeah, sure. Men and women.
No Tomb Raider.
Yes.
Female protagonist, my dad.
Our female lead, one of our core principals, is a 19-year-old cinema actress who's managed at the height of her fame and dies headlong into the search for the city. And it takes a while to tell you why she's so obsessed with that. So I wouldn't, not necessarily an Angela and the lead type.
What is so unique about this fantastic group in Laura Gilbert?
So unique about them. I think that the conceit is a pretty easy one to grasp. The people who believe the comforts of the known world to go into these dark places where science and reason give way to get a fable and nightmare. And in our version of it, because we do take off from a very boots on the ground historical reality, and then by these very small grades go into some crazy fantastic territory where these sort of monsters and strange things you see are just as real as a conversation you might have just having in a drawing room. So we treat it with kind of equal seriousness. I think that's what makes the way we envision these people as somewhat unique, in that they combine what Kevin's talking about, which is the sort of almost existential stage of the people having to solve these problems without any cell phones, without any cavalry behind them, but being faced with these challenges that we kind of wonder how we would deal with ourselves. And they're not only facing the sort of challenges, the orthodox challenges of war and privation and all that, but also these very strange things happening sort of in the fringes of the world that I don't want to spoil for you, but it, really rather strange.
Talk about the role of discovery and adventure that plays in Explorer Life, and also how you actually translate that on the visual graphic end.
Well, for me, this is a process of learning as we went. We had 3.5 years to do this, and it was an amazing opportunity, because most projects I work on are fairly short. You get in, you get out, and you don't have a chance to learn a lot. And in this one, we had a time to develop the look. We had a time to kind of adjust the look as we went. And so early on, I was sort of maybe going for some bigger action, some kind of bigger stakes in drawing that weren't necessarily supporting kind of the lead up to when you really need. So, for instance, I was kind of maybe going to silhouettes a little too early. And that was something that we discovered. Let's leave these silhouettes to the times where we really want to amp up the mystery and the conflict and make it mysterious at the same time. So we could deal with a lot of violence, but we could do it in a way that's also mysterious.
Parts where I could, sort of panel by panel, kind of picture here, right, I think I'm thinking this year. And there are other passages where, something very strange would happen, and I'm sort of like, gotten thing. And there's one in particular that's very, very strange. It's sort of, I don't know how many times this is strange, I apologize. I forgot about this one. It's in the middle of a seance, and then a sort of a very, and Rick is like, I'd rather people just imagine this as bizarre as I can hear it right now, but we did this one. So the formula wasn't set, so we're always sort of feeling our way through it.
John, former editor of the Harvard Lampoon, were you able to bring any humor to this incredible book?
We had that question today, not were you able to, but you got to drop the humor. I think it's there. It's not, you know, not too many pies in the face kind of thing. It seems pretty sober. There's the violence is definitely there, the action is definitely there. The mind for the humor or humor, you really have to get a feel for it. It's, I don't know, subtle, it's pretty dark. I think it's there. It's not, I wouldn't call it a laugh riot, but that's my mind.
This has been such an exciting India project. I'm sure the next one will be less than a year. Hopefully, publish it online or something. Sorry for putting you on the spot. What does volume 2 look like?
Yeah. Well, it was pretty arrogant to put volume 1 on it. It's really getting out over our skis. What were we thinking about? But I hope that we do, because so much has come of this. I alluded to it before, which is a level of friendship. And you don't know the friends you make along the way. There's people that fall away, there's people that come into your life, and there's sometimes you get associated with people that make you better at what you do. I certainly feel like I'm standing with giants. You know, I've said before to people that I could not have written this book by myself. But I know for a fact that John, Eric would have written it by himself. I was real honored to be able to contribute to that book to the point where he felt that I should be credited. But I gotta say, I feel, if I didn't say that out loud, I think these two guys are really, really special and will take their place this century. And I feel kind of a special obligation to prop them up. And it's not that they need me, but it's at this moment in time, the way we work, I really feel that there's something special about these two brothers.
It sounds like the song, just listening to the three of you, it sounds like the song is greater than the whole here. But what the three of you, from having the storytelling, love, yeah, the picture, and John, with narrative, humor, and Rick's incredible illustration when you brought together, it could never happen individually.
That's right. I mean, the way that it sounds so phony when we're constantly in a position of sort of like batting back his compliments, like, you know, trying to give it even more sort of force. But it is true. It is possible we could have made a book. It would not have been this book. It would have been very much a diminished book. I think what Kevin brings. I cannot impress on you enough what a disjointed, sort of heavy, somewhat fantastic mess I laid in front of him 9 years ago. And his feel for people and humanity and the way that, in a very human way, we face dilemma and the way that, you know, we behave and people's thought process in extremity. He has a grip on that, such a natural grip on that, and when you bring that component to this Cuckoo story we brought in, you begin to throw a line to the reader, you make a connection, a very human connection to the reader, and without that, I don't think all our fantastic points of story would count for much at all. So, I mean, not for him.
Why did I add that when I came on the project again, you know, halfway through this whole situation about 4 years ago, and I met Kevin for the first time, and I was unknown to him, and a lot of us, he was unknown to me. And he looked at me, kind of stopped, and took a second, and said, you know, we want to make a book that people are going to read for generations. You know, whether they do that, we don't know. We want to put that kind of quality into it. And he gave us the space to do that. You know, quality for him was bottom line. It wasn't like, hey, let's bang this out and make it pop. It was, we're going to make the best thing we can possibly do. And so he was the one who allowed us that space for the three of us.
Sorry, just adding on. So, you know, we see it when we go up, but there's that footage shot of us of the place in Santa Barbara, the beach in the background, it's very nice, and you guys had a lot of fun running around with berets on. And it's like, no, you aren't your spot up there. You cannot bring something up there that's not up to scratch, or you do not get to stay there. And not fully fitting kind of illustration of that is we're signing part that about 3,000 of them designed this sort of stitching of this book. And I'm doing it outside, I'm on this board, and I feel kind of a shadow coming over, and it's kept looking down. It's my goddamn signature. You know, I've done already being 1,500 of these. No, you're getting such a grasp in front of my face, crumples it. You're getting tired. Look at this. This one doesn't go with the other one. He's kidding, but the point was, you know, there's no room for, you know, don't bring that. I mean, I'm not going to use the full term line, but I'll bring that with that shit.
I think a lot of you this evening are actually not going to be going to sleep and be reading the book all night long.
You know, we're doing it on weekend, so that's so far that's the mark to be.
We're going to take a couple of audience questions. It's not easy for us to see up on stage, so if you could just deal with your time, please, lady right here. Yes, you won a lot of them.
Okay.
Oh, I mean, before I'm here.
My mother loves Sierra Capital. So I say hi to
my mother. I think it's important to ask the mother that.
Yeah, okay. I don't know how many times I have to ask you to go and ask you to go. Because you're a great teacher, like you're a queen teacher. So, I think for me, it was a movie I loved the movie. So, I've never heard of this another movie, then who do you want to, you know, use after?
You.
Take,
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, what was the question?
Yeah.
Who would you like to use? Yeah. Who would you like to
use? No, no, no. Oh.
Influence or what you would call
Well, I guess I would see different things in life. In the hands of a careful storyteller, you see the world differently. I was telling John about this, he hadn't seen this moment, but there's a great moment. Let's take the movie Giant. Who's seen Giant? There's a great moment where we get to the end of this 3-hour movie, which, by the way, I love them all. And that's why this book was operated. But I remember watching that particular story, and it's at the end, and as you know, just back upon it, Mark Hudson has a big oil baron, a big Texas, good-looking, strapping guy, was really basically a bit of a bigot. There was a lot of discrimination towards Mexican Americans. And he had this great architecture of this movie, a guy that seemed to be able to control his whole world, which was Texas. Suddenly he couldn't control his growing kids who marry a Mexican-American woman. That confused him. He's married to a beautiful Elizabeth Taylor. We go through this epic movie, this family that has all the money in the world, that has the same problems that all of us have, the ups and downs and the embarrassments. And now at the very end of this movie, Rock Hudson finds himself with Elizabeth Taylor. They're in this little diner shop in West Texas, and he is with his daughter-in-law, obviously a Mexican woman, their little grandchild, who is very brown. And they sit into this diner, and Rock is now gray. Elizabeth has gray hair. And they just kind of have a simple meal. And we've watched the architecture of this man this whole movie. And a man comes over, and he simply won't serve them. He won't serve them their lunch because of his Mexican daughter-in-law who was baby. And Rock, he can't believe it. And he stands up, and the guy says, "Hey, I fought in Korea. I can decide who I want to serve and who I don't want to serve." And Rock Hudson gets into a fist fight, an all-out fist fight with this man. And of course, Elizabeth Taylor is standing now in the booth. She's crying. Tears are coming down. His daughter-in-law is crying, the baby's crying. These two full-grown men are bloodying each other, all against the yellow rose of Texas. And again, Rock loses. He loses this fight. And he's crumpled up against the wall. And I'm really confused by this. I'm a young man watching this. To this point in my life, heroes are supposed to win. And my hero, the guy I was rooting for, he was beaten up. He was bested by another man. And Elizabeth Taylor goes over to him, and she leans down to him, and she's crying. He's bloody. And she looks at him. And I was kind of embarrassed for Rock that he lost. I was a young boy, 8 or 9. And Elizabeth wasn't. And she wiped away her tears, and she looked at him, and she said, "You never stood taller." Mm-hmm. I suddenly thought different about that moment. And it was because of great writing. It took this moment. Our hero lost, but in some way, he won. And I began to change it. That may seem very obvious to everyone in the room, but to me, it was great storytelling, and it changed the way I thought. And those kind of influences, people who took their time, it's just those things move me. I like the poetry of being a man. I love the poetry of the boldness that comes with being a man. All the things that come with being a man, and the same with women. When you're in careful hands, they take you to these places, and sometimes we find that we're glad that we're not somebody we're reading about, and sometimes we wish we were the person that we're reading about.
Tell me the last one you used to be talking about.
Continuing on that note on storytelling and influences, if you feel comfortable, can you briefly share the Richard Burton family story?
So much has been made of that, but as I was trying to decide what I wanted to be in my life, and everybody's asking me, if my kid, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And you think, oh my God. I grew up in a very blue collar. My dad wore Levi's and Levi shirts, and he looked as good as Paul Newman. He was strong, he was a fist fighter, he was a tough guy, and he was the hardest guy I had to tell, you know. I mean, I remember, you know, one of the harder things, I'm getting away from the British story, but honest to God, you know, you asked me, and you know, I remember when I told, you know, my dad that I wanted to be an actor, and his head just went. It was so hard on him, because, you know, he didn't, he loved me, but he was afraid that I would be embarrassed. And he didn't know how to help me. And, you know, sometimes the people that love us hold us back the most. And it was because he didn't want me. He just didn't want me to be humiliated. And so I remember when I told him that I was going to direct, he went. I remember he said, "Jesus Christ, Kevin, this acting thing is going really good." And so you know, I remember when I decided I would make music again, and it was like the last person I told, of course, was my dad. that little moment of seeing Richard Burton, he was on an airplane. I was literally on my honeymoon, and he got on the plane first, and he bought like 5 seats all around him so that no one could sit next to him. And the rest of us just were on our tiptoes looking at him go on the plane with this beautiful woman. And we all got on the plane, but I was burning up inside because I was grappling with the idea of God being an actor. And I thought to myself, that's a sign from God. And surely God was going, no, it's not. So we're on the plane, and everybody sees him sit down. I remember him reading a book, but I got up, and my wife didn't even know I was burning with this idea of what I was going to be in my life. And I walked, and of course, as I walked over to talk to him, the whole airplane, if you can imagine, the wave and the shaking all over. Completely happened, and I touched the legendary brawler. And he looked at me, and I looked very young, and I said, "Excuse me," I said, "when you get a moment, can I ask you a bit of advice?" And he looked at me, and he was thinking, "Jesus, 5 seats is not enough to keep." I don't know what I was thinking, but he looked at me, and he said, "Well, when I finish here reading this book, yes." And he was reading Gorbadal's Lincoln. And I watched him talk out. When I sat back down, I know my wife was like, "What is she?" And the whole point was, "What are you thinking?" And I just sat down. It was something very internal. And so I watched him the whole trip. Watch him read that book. And all of a sudden, he puts the book down, he closes it very carefully, he puts it in the pocket in front of him, and he leaned back in the seat and he went to sleep. So I'm watching him, fuck, he's gonna wake up. So he did. He took about like a little cat nap for about 5 minutes and he turned back to me and he with the trick of his finger he waked me. I walked up again in the plane like and we had a talk, it was just between us, and I went and sat back down. I remember it's funny that you bring this up, but we didn't have a lot of money on my honeymoon, and I remember my parents drove us to the airport. And we were going to catch a bus back to the Disneyland Hotel in LAX. And my wife and I, we were sitting, of course, he got whisked through customs, and we were sitting on our suitcase, like it happened when, you know. And also, this, we're sitting on the little median, my wife's on the suitcase, I'm on a suitcase like this, and, you know, not exactly like I was a great provider. We were going to take a bus to Anaheim, and our parents were going to pick us up again. This big limousine came literally probably about 8 inches from my face and just stopped and we were like this. And the window came down and he looked at me and said, "Good luck." And the window went up and he drove on like a stranger car. And I never got a chance to ever talk to Richard again, so he had no idea. But it was a small conversation, a too long of a story, I apologize, that you asked for. Thank you.
describe it, Zechariah Thomas is independent, what would it be called and what the illustration would look like?
You read the Declaration of Independence.
That's
a good question.
Are you not happy with the Declaration?
Let's consider this book our declaration.
Could we go first over there, please?
What were each of your favorite graphic novels?
Please.
You know, I've actually had a question like this before. I go back to the kind of old stuff. I'm a huge fan of early 20th century adventure. And I know that you're going to say, well, that's not a graphic novel, but in a way it is. It's one continuous story, and it's about 1,000 pages long. So we didn't get there. We were trying, and we wanted to match that. But I would say that's one of the huge influences on me. And, we know it's not like everybody here should go on and check that out, and find it as soon as they get the chance. Also, that continuity. A lot of it was proto graphic novel, but at the same time, it could be in different pieces as well.
I'm going to say Richard Burns or Charles Burns. That's how much I'm attached to answer. Charles Burns, Black Hole is my love. It is really, it is 180 years from this, so this is not one of my less good answers. But it's bizarre. It has the thing where it starts kind of, you kind of think it's one sort of story and it just goes off from there. He's an incredible artist. Like some very serious, I think, high level neuroses to do that type of art that he does, which I appreciate. Kim Beach is another favorite artist. But Black Hole is the one where I really thought this is a heavyweight story, and it's all fiction. I cannot imagine how long it took to make it, but yeah. A lot of what I've been promised to me is like, this is a heavyweight piece of graphic, because I'm not a big comics guy, and I've always wanted to try this, and I never found them to have that depth of real literature. And that's the one I think that comes closest to me.
Very good question.
So the question is, how does the
graphic novel portrait kind of lead? And this brings up a question that we were talking about in the car on the way over here. Somebody had asked us, do you think it's kind of, what was the word, dangerous? Do you think it's dangerous to try to tell an adult story in pictures? And one of the things, I think that we, as a society, we're coming back around with the rise of the graphic novel, but when comics were first invented, for the first 50 years or so, everybody read comics. Adults, kids, they got the Sunday page, and adults were reading Hank Downey, they were reading Flash Gordon. All these things were considered, maybe not on par with high literature, but they were certainly considered a kind of literature that adults took seriously. And we've gotten away from that with, people in tights and stuff like that. I think it's sort of skewed for kids. But to me, it's kind of like, well, why not? Why not try to use both literature, the literary quality of writing, and beauty of art, and try to tell a story that adults can really enjoy and has to have depth to it. And again, that's not what we're doing now. I think there's still a stigma against that, but not for us.
Well, I have a little bit of a bias against the format, just because I've been told over and over, this is literature but it happens to have pictures, and it never seems to measure up. I can't put much on Rick's answer, but I am going to take a good answer, sort of snapping all the energy out of the room after some giving them. But I will say that one thing I wanted to do was to not have a book that partition the art and the words, that you can't, using the panels, you can't distance them from one another. You can't say, well, this I'll flip past these ones and maybe I'll catch those pictures and aren't those nice. And they just sort of fly by like, you know, trees on the side of the road while you're driving. It was, the text was going to go through the panels. You could not get the full breadth of the story unless you immersed yourself in the art as well. So we thought, I will tell you, it was a much harder sell conceptually to people than we ever would have thought. I think when you open it, I hope, it feels kind of intuitive. This is the way the story is going, and once you calibrate to that, you can get into it. We heard a lot of, this is kind of between two chairs, is a phrase that I would love. And it's not, it's not a Fisher Fowl, it doesn't keep going as a traditional novel, and it doesn't, it's not always the panel graphic novel. But I'm hoping we kind of took a step back from form and just what we're concentrating so much on story. If I am an artist like Rick, I was going to use it as much as I could, honestly.
I just had one fan question. When I first came on the project, I didn't
know. She didn't ask a question.
Thank you. So I had this fanciful idea when I came on the project, what if, in the early 20th century, Joseph Conrad, great figure in literature, and he was this great figure in comics, met, because they were aware at the same time, at a party, it would be like, you got your chalk and my peanut butter. What if they, collided and said,
this is another one.
What if they made a project together? So, in my head, that's kind of the way I was thinking about it. Why not? What would that look like? And to me, I think this is what it would look like.
So, the gentleman over
here. Yeah, Kevin, over the years, I've seen so much of your work. And I've always wanted to do that. I love that. I've always wanted to do this. I want to thank you for your real difference.
Well, it seems like every time there's something I really want to do, I end up paying for it myself. I don't go off in life, and if I say I want to do something, I do it. So in my life, 5 or 6 times, I've had to push it all into the center and look it across to somebody. I don't know how to make black or white. I don't know how many people saw it. And pay for it. The answer is the same thing, and you go right down the line. And we wanted to make this book. What's the most gratifying? Well, I pitched the perfect game in Yankee Stadium, I've been able to taste Buffalo, something that people haven't done for 100 years. And I've been in the bathtub with Susan Sarandon. So which is most? It's been a good role for me.
Quiet and sort of desperate and not always tremendously fun thing. That's about 90% of it. And then I would get to check in. When I would check in with these guys, it was by far the most rewarding thing. I would see Rick, especially toward the end, sort of degenerating when he had just hundreds and hundreds of pages to do, you know, trying to sort of fuck him up, EP-Pong to fuck me up. And just knowing that somewhere else in the city there was another light on in another room, and there's another guy suffering the same self-doubt, and, you know, sort of can't go on, gotta go on, sort of mentality. And then, you know, the times when we got to go to the mount, and got to hear, you know, what Kev had to say, what he was doing. And, you know, having the conversations we would have, because it literally, this will sound strange, is like going up and visiting the man who's living with the characters that we're talking about. They were milling around in his house, and he would, you know, certain passages he would say, he wouldn't do that. Or if she went out that way, no, if she's going to say that, she would first, you know, we need someone who's going to come and, you know, be orchestrating this stuff. I really felt that Kevin is much more of a living process, and I don't know if that's the acting part, he can speak better to that, obviously, than I can. But it was, you go and you walk or we sit on a sofa and you tell the way he talks. The stories come out of it, and being witness to that. And I'm just writing as fast as I can. And it's just sort of taking this down. It's almost like, you know, a medium or something. I don't know where this thing is coming from. I just want to say, go in for a fun time, check in over your fun time. The rest of it is not, you know, not much.
It is on the board. It's creatively very satisfying. But, you know, my anecdote was I would roll out of bed, go to my drawing table, and then 12 hours later, I would leave.
I'm going to take one last question from somebody in the back. There's somebody standing there. So if you can answer
the question. To follow on the other fellow's question, Kevin, I'm a big fan, particularly of, I admire particularly some of your lesser-known movies, such as The Love of the Game, When You're Cycling Back, American Flyer. But one in particular, and Joe will remember this from last year, when Chief Marin was our guest. I asked this question, and asked the same one of you. For those who saw Tin Cup and those then, I don't think I'm giving away too much of the story. You know what Roy McAvoy did? What would Kevin Costner do? Would he take the drop?
I told you, I have pushed everything that I have owned so often into the middle. I don't know if those of you ever saw How the West Was Won. I saw it when I was 7 years old. It was a 4-hour movie, and I didn't miss a beat of it. But there's this great moment at the end where you get to watch these films over a 100-year period. And Debbie Reynolds has this great relationship with the great Gregory Peck. And he's a gambler. He's kind of a no-good guy. Or at least that's the way other men think about him or describe him to Debbie, because they want to be with Debbie. But at the end, these two were like made for each other. They were just built for each other. She was an entertainer. He was a no-account gambler. And at the end of the movie, he's gone. And everything, they live on Knob Hill. They've had all the wealth in their entire life. And an auction is going on. She's going to leave everything on Mount Hill, sell it all. She's going to go be with her grandchildren in Prescott, Arizona. And I don't know if any of you saw the movie, but there's a moment that she describes her life, and she describes the man that she was with. And she said, and as they're talking, there's this gold train, a solid gold that had to do with the joining of the continent. And they were obviously there. It was probably worth $1 billion. And they said, I'm sorry, ma'am, this is just insult. And of course, they take it away. She's talking. And she looks at this man and she said, you know, me and my husband, we made and lost 3 fortunes. And had this complete, I remember I'm like 7 years old, we made and lost 3 fortunes. And I could tell she was still in love with that man. And I could tell he was somebody that swung for the fences. And I thought to myself, I want to be that kind of man. So I would not have tried. I would have gone for, I mean, Iraq is dangerous. Afghanistan is dangerous. We live in a dangerous world. Going for a birdie is not dangerous.
Ladies and gentlemen, if everybody could just remain seated for 2 minutes, and while Heather and John and Rick are asked for that, please join me in fact and really enjoy.